Hi, this is Mike Palmer. This is a special episode of Trending in Education based on a panel that I moderated at South by Southwest EDU in Austin, Texas. You'll hear from Dana Gastic French, Dr. Deshanna Reed, and Poonam Saxena. It's a bit of a different direction than maybe some of the conversations we've had. A little more hands-on, practitioner-level conversation in K-12 about how to become a link, how to connect community, culture, and collaboration through this trifecta of busting silos. We hope you enjoy. There's a nice panel here of experts who are representing the trifecta of community, culture, and collaboration. Oh, yeah. I'd like to introduce myself first. I'm Mike Palmer. I will be moderating this session, as my T-shirt indicates. Thank you very much to my panelists for providing me with wardrobe for today's session. And for today, we have three folks here who have a really interesting origin story that ties to this very event, taking yourself back to 1 year ago. I'll allow them all to introduce themselves. And we'll kick this panel off, starting with Dana Gastic French. Dana, welcome.
Hey, everyone. I'm Dana Gastic French. I am a multilingual learner consultant. I have a firm that is housed in the Northeast, just north of Boston. And my background is one of an ESL educator. I was, for a moment, a bilingual teacher because they lost a teacher and said, "You speak Spanish." That was fun. And I then became an instructional coach and eventually a district EL director in an urban district north of Boston. About 2 years ago, I endeavored to go out on my own and try to really do what I view as cross-pollinate, take these great practices that were happening in one district and allow that to actually be seen and heard and implemented elsewhere. And by working within one system and being owned essentially by one system, it didn't feel like I was making that traction. That's what we do at Upriver, and now today I'm representing this vantage point of the multilingual learner educator, or one of the potential subgroups, you know, of the many subgroups that exist. Because as you will see, and as we'll talk about, we have a lot of shared experiences in parallel that we're not necessarily having the opportunity to convene and discuss together. I'll move it to Deshanna.
Hi, I'm Dr. Deshanna Reed. I am an educational consultant in special education advocacy coach focusing on inclusion. That's primarily where I live. I'm also a social emotional learning researcher with a background in behavioral health psychology. I actually started off in education as an ACP. I did not go to school for education. I went to school for psych, which actually is education if we really think about it. So I did go into education really wanting to make a difference, particularly in the lives of those who are differently abled. I'm the youngest of four, and one of my older sisters lives with autism. She's level three. And so I knew from that vantage point what it was like to be a family member of an individual who is differently abled. I understood what my parents' environment was like, especially considering my sister got her diagnosis back in the 1960s, before there were laws to really protect families like mine and individuals like my sister. And so I'm the daughter of activists, and so naturally it made sense for me to rock the boat as often as possible, but do so from the classroom. I was a special education teacher. I taught PPCD, preschool program for children with disabilities. I taught life skills, resource. I also went on to do general education for all of the elementary grade levels. I don't need to ever do that again, but I did do it. Middle school was my favorite. I was a middle school math and science teacher for some years. I became a campus administrator, and I oversaw special education programming for a charter school system in the Houston area. And then I bookended my K-12 public career as a special education transitions teacher. So I ran the gamut from the beginning all the way into post-secondary. I'm an adjunct professor right now at Lone Star College, in addition to owning my consulting firm, D. Reed Coaching, Consulting, and Advocacy. And I focus on social-emotional learning integration with core competencies And I also provide professional development to teachers, school leaders, and to families to help them really understand the process of special education and how to actually cultivate and facilitate accessible, equitable, and inclusive learning environments for students of all abilities. And that's really the long and short of my story.
Maybe I should have gone second. Hi, I'm Poonam Saxena. I am a parent impact coach who works with parents to break down barriers that they feel walking into the schools and working with schools to invite parents to come in and engage with their administrator in the schools while also helping their students. I am a special education teacher who left education several years ago when I started our family, and I realized when I was in the classroom that parents were not walking through the door. No one wanted to be a part of what happened in my classroom. And yet it kept coming back to me that the parents are the ones who are actually the experts of their children. And if we're not engaging them, Dana and I had this conversation last night, engaging is so overused. But if we're not seeking our parents as partners in their child's education, then we have lost a valuable resource. So since I've had my children who are now grown and gone and doing their own amazing things, I have been doing this work through my podcast and speaking engagements, my TEDx talk, author of a couple of books, one that is called Powerful Parenting, 101 Ways to Stay Positive. It's a parent affirmation journal, and it's really for everybody, for every single one of us to remember the importance of what we do every single day. And it has a prompt in there, and you can journal, but it's really to lift us all up through these difficult days that we may have as a parent.
Amazing stuff. Just show of hands in the audience. I imagine K-12 folks here, pretty much the whole crowd. Okay, how about a multilingual learning, bilingual, that kind of stuff? Some representation there. All right. And then how about special ed and some of the stuff that Deshaun, okay. And then parents, I imagine there's some parents in the room and folks who think about
Come
what
on,
it's like to
high.
Be an educator.
Yes.
Exactly. And interestingly, I think some of you probably put your hands up more than once, which is one of the ideas that I think we're trying to touch on here, because we want to talk about the problem. You know, any good conversation needs to begin with a problem statement. Panelists, what's the problem? What are we here talking about?
I would say one of the biggest problems, and on my social media, what I really do a lot is video posts. And one of the video posts that I led with was that silos equal stagnation. And the biggest challenge that I encountered as a special education teacher in particular was the fact that I was so compartmentalized because I was the teacher that taught those sweet kids over there. I see some nods, right? And so the expectation was that I was the expert on all things that had to do with neurodivergence. And for a small portion of that, yes, my specialties really are with individuals living with autism and others that have some maybe sensory and communication disorders. That's where I live. But that does not make me the be-all, end-all expert on all of it. But the expectation was that I was because I was a special education teacher. So I must know all the things about all of it, right? But I didn't need to know anything about general education except for how to teach it and make the accommodations and the modifications and sit in the meeting and translate all the information and communicate with, you see what I'm saying? And so being siloed in that realm made it very difficult for me to really make meaningful connections across content and even into the multilingual space, even though in the district where I taught, I had a lot of students that were multilingual learners that also had differing abilities comorbid. And so if I didn't ever have the opportunity to really connect with multilingual learner teachers to find out what they're doing, and I didn't really have the opportunity to engage with general education teachers outside of when they needed an assessment or they needed me to come take care of a behavior because they were doing the most in that class, other than that, like, I wasn't ever really having the opportunity to engage. So the biggest piece to me is the fact that we are so siloed. And then we're confused about why we're siloed when we keep siloing ourselves.
Right. And we're talking about solutions a little bit later, but y'all are kind of an example of the solution, which is breaking down the silos. And the three of you got together here. You met at South by Southwest EDU. One of the things I really love about this conference is that it's not a higher ed conference. It's not an enterprise conference. It's not a special ed, multilingual learning. It's more about everybody coming together and learning from each other, being in community with each other. And then there's a lot of like happy accidents, serendipity, lucky connections. You meet people in different fields and then you learn we're not different. We're actually very similar and we're stronger together than when we're separate. And Deshauna laid out the problem from her perspective. And then can the three of you talk about how you connected here, maybe picking up with you, Dana?
Yeah. Absolutely. So a year ago, we met at a roundtable session, I want to say. These two ladies were facilitating. I was participating. It was my first time here at South By and just wound up having this really additive conversation. And I think as these things go, we arrive at these conferences and we say every year at the conference, we're going to transform education. My guess is that at South by Southwest 2034, we're going to be transforming education, right? But at what point is it transformed? And I think it's a wonderful experience. It's a feel-good experience. But what the three of us agreed on in our souls was that we had learning to gain from one another, and we were working in parallel. We were working. We had these beautifully forged gears that were parallel to one another, and we're not actually linking up in order to create that forward momentum. We were solving the same problems with different jargon. The problem I was trying to solve in isolation was the same problem that Deshauna was looking at, the same problem as Poonam. And I imagine for so many of you, there are so many intersections and subgroups and groupings and age groups and content areas that you're thinking about and trying to solve, but it doesn't feel like it's forward unless we converge. And that's where this was born from.
Yeah. Poonam, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, when you come to a conference, and I believe it was all of our first times last year, and we all just you gravitate towards people that are like-minded, and this conference has so many like-minded people that it's not humanly possible to meet everyone. And I always thought that my niche was a little out of the box, right? Because when we talk about education, we really don't go down the parent road, and I want to caveat this because last year when I spoke here, as someone in the audience, correct me, when I'm talking about parents, I'm talking about the guardian of the child. It could be the grandmother, the aunt, the uncle, the foster parent, you know, whoever the guardian of this child is. But when you start talking to people, we realize that we really are working together. We're just not working together. And so instead of spinning our wheels, at this year's conference, I'm seeing a lot more collaborative efforts in different sessions in which we're now starting to de-silo all of these, you know, segments of education that we're all experts in, by the way. Every single one of us is an expert in our silo. But there's so much that we can do together, and it will take less energy, and we will move forward faster when we start to bust those silos and build that community.
I think when you said the energy piece, I think that's probably the biggest thing I think that really did draw us together. Obviously, we're here for a reason, right? But I think energy, that's the biggest piece because in our classrooms and in our campuses, speaking at it from a very multifaceted approach that I've got, right? Considering the energy that we expend trying to, as administrators, go over here to this program and deal with what's going on in this program, go to that program and deal with what's going on in this program, and then go to the other one, and the two shall not meet, but we really wish they would meet, but we're not going to introduce them. It's like being at a party, and you have that one person that could connect you to that other person over there, but they're just standing there looking at you and looking at the other person, wondering why you're not talking to each other. It was essentially like that. And then as a teacher, really wishing that I had administrators that were willing to rock the boat as much as I was willing to. And so the energy that I had to expend as a teacher running from place to place to place because they wouldn't just create a bridge between us all was super frustrating. And ultimately, I was starting to feel super burnt out because I'm over here essentially feeling like I'm running a dead sprint all by myself with nobody to pass the baton to, because they didn't even know I was running behind them. And so the energy piece, I think, is super important to really focus on, because it does help us really do move the needle forward that much faster. Yep. And in favor of kids winning, because we want them to win. We really do. We've gotten ours and we're still getting ours, but they haven't gotten theirs yet. And we want them to be able to do that. And it's going to take us using our energy smart, not hard. Old Army term for me, because I'm a veteran, but work smart, not hard. And if we do that correctly and intentionally, that's how they all win.
There was a wonderful panel, the Trending in Education podcast panel on Monday.
Yes.
What they talked about were these prevailing trends that are happening in education. The one that stood out to me was ally versus accomplice. So my personal story is one where I felt as an ESL educator and then as an EL administrator, I came in with all the hope in the world that I was going to make this system run for these kids and their families. I was an ally and I felt this double bind where if I wanted to choose to be an accomplice, which means taking on a shared risk with the people you serve, right? Because oftentimes when we try to stand up for inequity, when we try to stand up for a lack of resource, for access, we become grouped in and marginalized, not in at the depth, of course, of that community, but in a similar way. And we don't necessarily then stay an accomplice because it's safer. I could have stayed in that role if I had said okay to my superintendent to stop speaking up and being that squeaky wheel. Had I had the collaboration and the community of the special education director who was clearly fighting the same fight for a different cause, but very similar, of the technology person, the student mental health director, had we all been, and I guess I'm getting a little bit into solutioning here and we can talk specifics in a bit,
sure.
But that would have reduced the isolation. I have a little quote here that I wanted to share from our keynote this morning. It really stood out where he said, "Sometimes the challenges that we think are insurmountable are simply the challenges we're trying to tackle our own."
Mm. Yeah. Testify.
So let's pull all of that together and let's talk about the parent role. A lot of you raised your hands as parents. When you're in education, it's difficult to unlearn what you know. You walk into your parent-teacher conference or the school or wherever, and you've got this base level knowledge, and you just can't unlearn that. It's like being a car mechanic and taking your car to a mechanic shop, and you know they're trying to upsell you, and you're like, no, but I know that. But here's the difference. What works in your classroom and the knowledge that you have isn't necessarily what works for your child. And so sometimes we have to pull ourselves out. And in qualitative research, it's called bracketing. You've got to bracket yourself out and look at your child individually. And when we start to do that, we start to see changes that we can make because we know and we have that base knowledge. But let me ask you a question. My husband is our cameraman over here. He's being awesome. So we had to go to see a lawyer last week. All good, nothing bad, but we had to go. And we're sitting there, and the first thing that he says to us is, "I'm going to throw a lot of vocabulary out at you, and you are not going to know what it means. But my job is to help you, because that vocabulary is very important to understand going forward so you can begin to advocate for yourself." Let's turn that into education. Most of our parents are not educators. And we're expecting them to walk in to our schools with a base knowledge that they don't have. We've made an assumption. We have to equip them with that vocabulary, not only to advocate in that moment in that school year, but we want that vocabulary to grow so that they can continue to advocate all the way through 12th grade and beyond. And so I urge you to think about those two issues of bracketing yourself, leaving your knowledge at the door and listening to what that teacher is telling you about your child. And the other is that we've got to start equipping our parents with the vocabulary that we are very comfortable with. We talk about curricula and data and assessments and changes and all the bureaucratic lingo. Our parents don't live in that world. And we shouldn't expect them to come to a meeting with that. So we've got to meet our parents where they are. And every parent's going to be different. And we joke all the time, there's a difference between being an advocate parent and a tiger mom parent. I was probably borderline. He's not going to say anything, but I was probably borderline. But it was important to understand that. But I had the education background. I could walk in and say the words that made them believe that I knew what I was talking about.
And then some of those parents may not even be native English language speakers. And then they also may come from a background that's very different than the teacher, the administrator. Each of you are coming at this from different directions, but you're all hustlers to a certain extent. You're all kind of out there on your own trying to get your thing off the ground. That can be a very competitive dynamic where there's limited funds out there. The hustle is real. I understand. I do it myself. I'd like to hear a little more from you about that aspect of the challenge where each of you may be doing great work and thinking about how you can work with others. But when it comes down to signing a contract or getting a deal with a particular school, you know, it can be a scarcity dynamic, which then starts to pull things back apart.
You all have maybe noticed that we have little links on. That, I think, ultimately is the key, is being the link. That's what we do. You establish the link and you are the link. And when we look at a chain in general, there are individual links on the chain and they're great for the function that they have. But if you actually want to be able to do anything with that, you want to lift something heavy, you want to pull something along, you're going to need every single chain on that link together to make that happen. That's what we do when it comes to this. And I'm a person that loves to collaborate with people. There's enough out here for everybody to eat. I'm not a person that is threatened by the person to the left or the right of me because I know what I have in my own respect. And I know I can say it only like I can say it. It doesn't bother me that I have other consultants that focus on different areas because their vantage point is always going to be different than mine, right? They don't have my lived experience. And so when I submit a bid to a school district, because that's typically how you have to do it as a consultant. You got to go for the bid and you got to fill out 1,100,000 paperwork, right? And then you have to have 18 different types of insurance and 13 letters from people that you haven't worked with yet to tell them that you can do your job. I mean, that's what it is on the other side. I'm just going to say what it is, right? And so you submit that forward. If I already know that going into that bid, there's going to be a piece that doesn't fit me, I'm tapping her and I'm tapping her and I'm tapping other people that are in my network and letting them know, hey, if you want to come on this with me, we could both eat. Come on. You can come with me. And that's the biggest thing. You have to be willing to be a link. You can't be about the business of siloing yourself in any way if we're actually going to do what we say we want to do to make the measurable change that we want to see in our systems. You have to be willing to do that. And even when it comes to my book that I wrote, the UDL for SDL, it has everything to do with collaborative systems and how you actually make that work. That's what you do so that it doesn't become one of those dog-eat-dog situations, because I'm completely over the hustle. I don't have time for that, and my shoes are too high. I don't have time for all that. So I'm looking to the left and to the right and forward and behind me always to see who else can come in here and eat on the same thing with me.
Yeah, and it can be hard to open up. Not to go too far on the link metaphor, which I love, but the link, when it opens, is the weakest it's going to be. And it's also an opportunity to connect.
I would love to extrapolate this concept really to the K-12 setting. So we work in school buildings. There is a scarcity, right? So the lack of resource, the thin of resource is real. I think we feel that probably more so as we approach all these scary cliffs of funding, right? Maybe we all ate well for a little while there if you were a recipient of those funds, but it's not just money. It's time, it's attention, it's scheduling priority, right? There are so many pieces at which we are positioned to be in conflict with one another, in competition at a minimum. And so the onus to move forward and be that link and to say, hey, special educator, I'm the EL teacher, let's collaborate on this. That's challenging. A lot of times it's a lot easier to just make your own solo appointment with your principal and go in there and advocate for the thing that you need. At the end of the day, that is a short game, is what we're here to say. For several reasons. For one, you're not going to build inefficiencies. And someday your number's not going to be up and you're not the one who's going to get to that door first. It's going to create this infighting and it's not good for the kids in general. But I think, too, teaching is such an isolating profession. Administering is more isolating, I would say. We talk about teachers in isolation. But you know what? Nobody did like a fun, funky theme administrator day when I was an administrator. But I envied the teachers who did and the teams. So there's also a retention issue here. I think it was Beth Reddit that said it takes 250% to replace someone. So if we're thinking about how do we keep our educators, that's a lot of knowledge, that's a lot of systems, that's a lot of protocols and processes that they are developing. We have to create community within schools. In order to do that, we need to create community, not just amongst the educators, but as Poonam says, with the families as well. So that when we talk about culture here, so that we are imprinting the culture and the culture of the school is evolving with the people that are there today, not just a reflection of the school when it first opened its doors.
It's funny because this is a conversation I've been having a lot lately about the education system and the premise of how the education system was formed. And if you think about it, the education system that was developed for this country was way back in the 1600s when people first came, and it was for basically white Christian males. Women weren't educated. The Native Americans weren't educated. It was for one section of people. And as our country has grown and diversified thousands of times over since then, the box hasn't changed. We're still trying to put all of us into a box that no longer exists. We haven't evolved. And so our hope is that as we start to break down these silos, that that box grows, because we can't teach the same principles and concepts on the premise of what was built back then. We're no longer those people. And it no longer serves our children.
Can I hop in on that?
Sure.
Because
absolutely.
I think a piece that you mentioned is a really interesting take on it. Because, of course, yeah, going back to the lineage of what education looked like in our society back then, I think that there is some truth to that. But I also think, and of course, switching my brain to a differently abled concept, when we're looking at it in terms of that, Native American individuals in this country existed before they got here, and they did have their form of education. It just didn't look conformist. And that person's going to say things that are uncomfortable, and I'm totally fine with that. It wasn't conformist.
Right.
And that, unfortunately, is what we're looking for in our systems, is conformity. And when you don't, that's when you stick out as an anomaly, right? And that happens a lot for our special education students, too, because they're treated as if they're an anomaly, because they don't conform to what education was supposed to be, what it was supposed to happen. Back to the, I teach those really cute kids over there.
Right.
The ones that you could come get out of my room because they're cutting up. Come get them, Dr. Reed. Come get them out of my room. They're cutting up. Okay. But without identifying why it is that they are. For the record, please don't misunderstand. Don't come at me. I'm not saying that it is okay for somebody's child to pick up a desk and hurl it at you because they don't want to conform. That's not what I'm saying, so don't at me. But I am saying that there's something to be said about the fact that we're looking for compliance and conformity without actually really considering the access points that our students and our teachers in particular are coming with. So we've got to consider the accessibility piece of it, and educating people equitably is really the biggest difference between the way it was then and the way it is now. Now there's more and more talk about it, but that's not something that's new. These aren't new conversations that we're having, right?
Not at all.
But the equity piece has become more and more prevalent as we've noticed the very obvious gaps that don't just exist but persist. And we're unfortunately feeding those gaps ourselves So we've got a double-edged problem, right? And we're inadvertent. We're not intentionally like, you know, and as a matter of fact, I want to make sure that these little brown kids over here don't do well on these state assessments. I want to make sure they don't. Nobody's doing that. Nobody's really doing that. But we are inadvertently perpetuating a system of gaps while expecting conformity and compliance without equipping students with the tools that they actually need to not conform, because I don't want them to conform. I want them to be as much of a boat rocker as I am. In their own way, I want them to rock the boat as much as possible. But that, I think, is the biggest piece, is the equity and the inclusivity piece, too. Making that a space where, like with our intersection, when I had multilingual learner students that were also neurodiverse, if we weren't having conversations, our kids already lost.
It's so interesting when I hear you talking about conforming. I think there's a pressure, right, in schools to work within, right, work within this budget, work within these scripts that are coming out, these curricular scripts, these like exacting minutes with fidelity, right? Did I just make anyone nauseous by hearing that? But here's the one thing that, to me, conforming, how do we make someone conform? To me, there's a couple of ways, but in both ways, we isolate. So I see this in the ESL world is either we pedestalize on this pedestal that's fit for just one, and we say, she, Mrs. So-and-so, does such a phenomenal job. She holds up our entire ESL program. She just makes it work. These are paraphrases from stakeholder interviews I've done from principals who say, she is the most amazing teacher. I don't know what our program would do without her. Well, guess what? She is all alone in that. So they put her up on this pedestal. She is alone. And then she can't disrupt, right? Because she has no allies. It's either that or she or he, they just keep asking for so much. And then we gaslight them into thinking that they're the ones who's asking for too much. So I think the other power, right? So isolation is the thing we do to protect and heed against non-conforming. But what we need to do is actually not conform in order to move, right, to agitate, to move systems forward. We're much more equipped to disrupt safely if we do that as a group, right? We have to create and build those links together so that I didn't trust my own voice as an administrator. I started to believe that I was indeed asking for too much, which was, in effect, basic access to education. I started to believe them. And then I hopped out and started to become in communion with others who believe the same and recognize I wasn't the crazy one. I work now in districts who want the same thing that I was told to be quiet about. But because I was alone, I didn't know that. So we need this in order to stay in this profession and to be there for the people we're there for.
And I just want to make one comment about conforming. Conforming to what? And conforming to whom? Who is right? When we talk about conforming, is it me, the first generation Indian American who grew up in rural Georgia right after integration? Oh, that was a ride. So should people conform to me or should I to you? And why can't education be as individual as the person sitting in that desk? Because I can assure you that my experiences have been very different than Deshauna and Dana's. And so when we look at our students, we need to ask the parents what their priorities are, because it may not be what was important to my family and my parents.
Yeah. I'm really glad you guys brought up the idea of conformity. You know, we made it 40 minutes in without talking about artificial intelligence, which might be a win.
You had to go there.
But I had to do it.
Really?
Somebody had to do it. When you think about the future of work, you're not looking to develop conformists. If it's a conforming mindset, that's something that could probably be automated. And in some ways, we actually do need to embrace difference in new ways. And then the other element that's available here is ideally more personalization. One thing I've heard, I talk to a lot of AI innovators all the time. One thing I've heard from more than one of them is the idea of an IEP for all. And same thing with Universal Design for Learning, which I know, Deshauna, you do that a lot.
Yeah, I do.
The assistive technologies, innovations that make it easy for differently abled or neurodivergent, neurotypical people ultimately help us all and ultimately advance into what really needs to be the future of education. So maybe it's time to start thinking a little more about the solutions. Where do we start? Folks are tapped out. Teachers are burnt out. You know, teachers' mental health. One of the other advantages, I think, of breaking out of your silo is really what I see among the three of you. And what I love about this conference is that there is community, there is fellowship, there's the ability to lean on other people. It does take that vulnerability, but I'd love to maybe shift into the solution space. How do we start to get there?
The biggest challenge that we have in education is that we've talked about silos, we've talked about working in our own spaces, but we don't talk about communication. You know, we have access to so many opportunities and ways to connect now. AI is one of them. You know, we have to communicate, but we have to communicate in the ways that the person who's receiving the information understands the information. How many of you on orientation day at school, which is, you know, please, it just makes me crazy to go in there with all these people running all over the place, but you come back with 2 pounds of papers. Okay, nobody tells you what's important in there. And you're sitting there, if you do not understand all these pieces, you're expecting someone who may not have the language or comprehension or even, you know, basic knowledge about the insurance or the free lunches. And we're expecting these parents to fill these forms out. And I don't know about you all, but I just stand at the trash can and just toss them because it doesn't engage me. It's a great metric and filing system for somebody at the school. But what are we gaining from it? We know nothing about the student other than the demographics of them. We have no personal connection. And the parent sends it all back. And guess what? They're done. They've checked their box. Their child has gotten an A for bringing all their papers back. And then we don't see them again until the 9 weeks, when you get that parent who thinks their child's doing great, come barreling through the door going, I can't believe you gave my child a Z. He's been working night and day. Well, had we had a chance to talk about it, I could have told you where those gaps are. So we have to have communication, and we have to start building relationships based on trust. I need to trust my child's teacher that they're doing the best that they can. But it's incumbent upon me, the parent, to tell the teacher what's going on in our home that might be affecting their performances in school. And so I'm going to tell a really quick story. And I have permission to tell this from my two daughters. We are not morning people. The girls, we are just crabby as they come. And high school in our district started at 7:01 in the morning. Now, try pulling 16-year-olds out of bed 5:45 to get ready to go to school.
Yeah, we have trouble with our 5-year-old getting in by 8:15, so yeah. I can't even imagine.
7:01. But I had built a relationship with the teachers and administrators so that I had their cell phone numbers. Never abused it, always respected the fact that we had a professional relationship. But I would text them, and I would say, good morning. I am sending you Oscar the Grouch today. Good luck. But it did two things. It let the teacher know that we had a rough morning, that probably weren't going to be on their A game when they got to school. And it gave my child an opportunity to feel good about where they were, even though they were still waking up. And 100% of the time, the teacher would text me back at the end of first period and say, just want you to know they're still waking up, but they're going to have a great day. Or they were wide awake by the time they got here. Something so simple. Let the teacher know that my child wasn't being belligerent or defiant.
Just humanize them with their reality.
Right? It's the reality. I mean, who wants to be anywhere at 7:01 in the morning?
I mean, I want to be at Starbucks at 7:01. I think what you really just spoke to is the connection piece. Because I think that the communication piece is important, but communication without a connection falls dead. And so for me, one of the biggest solutions that we can implement that's at our disposal that doesn't cost us a dime is presence. When we make the meaningful connections between teachers in different departments, different grade levels, and you actually align those vertically, not according to content, just according to children in common, I think that that's really helpful. Have that connectedness and make it intentional. Instead of the PLC, which is really great, how about we have a networked improvement community instead, where you have teachers that are linked, not just based on the content that they have, but also maybe their skill sets that they have in addition to that. And it's a network community of people who don't just teach third grade all together, or just the special education teachers who talk to each other about special education, because they already know about special education. Why are they talking to each other? They could be sitting in on the conversations with the math teacher, the history teacher, the science teacher, the social, whatever it is. All of those teachers can be together, including the arts, because that's something that also is extremely important. And research has shown time and time again how beneficial fine arts is. In addition to PE, I just have to put PE out there, okay? Because I love coaches. Coaches are amazing. But I feel like putting those things together in a networked improvement community is really what we need to be moving toward. And that's, of course, just going into the improvement science model that Bright et al. Had already put forth for us in a book called Learning to Improve. I didn't write it, but it's a really good book, right? So, right. Like, pick up a copy of that, right? Create a networked improvement community and connect. Make it intentional. And for administrators that are in the room, make it intentional that your teachers meet in a network, not just as their grade level planning and they sit with an instructional coach, they get their copies, they talk about what teachers they're going to teach, and they move on down the highway. That doesn't help. They really need to be talking to people who are not in the same content or even in the same grade level, because everybody at the beginning raised their hand according to which compartment you all actually belong to. But the truth of the matter is every single person in here is a special education teacher. Every single person in here is a general education teacher and a multilingual learner teacher. We all teach it. It just looks a little different based on what our title is, but we're all those same teachers. We all teach those same things, just like we all fit in different compartments, right? So the connectedness piece is really, really huge. And for my story, as a transitions teacher, I had one student in particular who was with Down syndrome and he was deaf. His mother was undocumented. He was not, but she was. And at home, there was only Spanish spoken. And unless he put those hearing aids in, which let me tell you, at 20, he wouldn't put those hearing aids in, okay? Because if he didn't want to hear, he would pop those things out real quick, right? So I had to make sure I came to the end where he could hear me and be like, ah, see, I got you, right? But even still, bridging the divide between his mother, who didn't want to come up to the school because she is undocumented and she was afraid, because that's the other piece that's a barrier for parents to accessing outside of institutional bias, where we keep them out because we only want them there to be there for orientation and maybe donuts with dads and muffins with mom and paper with people. If we don't want to do that, right? They don't come because it's like that, or they're afraid. And so when it's an environment where there's a true connection and it's not a judgment, I'm not going to judge the fact that you're undocumented because that's not my life. I don't have to walk that out. It's not my place to judge it. But I do have your child, and I want to connect with you in a way that's intentional. And how can I best do that with you? For me, that looked like activating my San Antonio brain and speaking Spanish to my non-native English-speaking parents. That looked like me intentionally going on home visits. As a person who taught 29 self-contained third graders at one point, did I go to every single one of those houses? You bet your boots I did. Because it was worth it for me to go to their house, spend a few minutes of time knowing them on their turf, talking with their parents in a way that was meaningful to them, to really bridge that connection. And every single one of those general education students or special education students did exceptionally well with their testing because they had that relationship. We had that connectedness, and their parents knew what I was doing and I knew what they were doing. So we had a connection back and forth between us. But did you do that in middle school too? Absolutely. Sure did. Did I do it as an administrator? Yep. 1 year, 550 students. It took me the entirety of the school year to do it, but I set foot in every single one of those kids' houses because it was worth it for me to do it. The connection was so much more important than my comfort. And so I'm not saying forsake your own family, because for the record, I got 4 children and I'm married. So I did it. I made it work. Almost ran me crazy, but I did it because it was worth it. So for me, the connection piece is huge.
For me,
A couple of the actionable things that come to mind are, number one, stakeholder groups, right? So can you bring together stakeholder groups? We often have councils that inform our district leadership. And those councils are great, but if you look around at them, they're typically not representative of the full school community,
yeah.
Right? They look a lot like the school boards, which also don't look a lot like the full school community or sound a lot like the full school community. What I've been able to do in several of the districts that I partner with is create multilingual stakeholder groups, which include students, they include families, they include teachers, but it's a safe space to actually bring up topics that are important to that group. They can have a representative to the larger council. However, they're able then to be a part of the conversation in a really safe way. Another possible action point for all of you is to think about what exists in your district as a ghost protocol. What are the things that if you left tomorrow, no one would know how to do? Or that just work that way because this is the way we do it. I think there's often a lot of time wasted and a lot of infighting and a lot left up to likability and chance when we say, you know, I'm trying to vie for this schedule for my students and my principal happens to like me. I mean, that actually matters so much in getting shit done. The point being, when you can point to a piece of paper and say, these are our non-negotiables in scheduling, I use that as an example, but there are so many, then it doesn't mean that the ability to get this done is contingent upon our relationship or whether or not she likes my RBF, right? That piece is really keeping us from moving forward because we're not operationalizing our schools in a way that's actually professionalizing us. And then it's kind of degrading us, right? But I think I want to just hook back to what Poonam said earlier about building those connections. Beth Reddit had said, we use stories to build empathy. I mean, her whole premise is that AI is not artificial, it's ancestral. It's pulling from us and recreating based on us. But stories, she said, to quote her, play a pivotal role in creating shared realities. I encourage you to look up ASCD's article on empathy interviews if you're not putting those into practice. Because if we can sit and listen to families, who is determining the culture of our schools is a big question. Yeah. And if we are trying to make them fit, and if there is a them, then there's something that has to be shifted. If our only events for parent engagement, and actually I was in a session this morning where they called it co-empowerment instead of engagement, which I really like. If we really want to co-empower, most likely that work is not going to look like something you can put on an Instagram post. It's not the celebration of diversity where everyone brings a dish and we have flags that we can take photos of. It's the quiet moment where I'm listening in your living room and you have tears in your eyes because you're not really sure if this survey is safe to take because you're undocumented. It's the simple times when the teachers are sitting there talking about how they can work out an equitable schedule. But all of those pieces are less pretty. But I think that's the work. That's where we have to move forward and say, I'm going to be that link and I'm going to show up and I'm going to value the less sexy times and right. Say, this is the real work. Sitting together, humanizing one another is the work.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have to do that kind of deeper, slow work in order to grow. Honoring that and valuing that and trusting in that, I think is going to get this job done.
Great stuff.
And we have a question.
I was making a lot of connections with what you were saying about connecting with parents, giving them the vocabulary, resources, support. And I have so many ideas, right? But I guess I'm wondering where to start. I did the math and I thought my 24 students, if I were to meet with them for 5 minutes individually each day, that's 2 hours. And right. It's a huge chunk of my instructional time. So when I thought about it like that, it really dawned on me that I could be, I don't know, I have this idea that I shouldn't be asking parents to do anything because I feel like it's my job, right? But how can I start that conversation with parents without making it feel like an extra obligation for them or I'm putting them out? You know, I know every family has different time constraints and time resources, et cetera. But yeah, I'm just curious what your ideas are for where to start that conversation with families.
So the first thing that I would say is let them know you're accessible. Let them know that you need their expertise and you're going to use them as a resource. Because as teachers, we have so many resources available to us. We may not be able to use them all, but we have them. We should be using our parents as resources too. And we need to be able to say, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I really need your input on this. because I see that Johnny is learning in a way that I want to captivate and encourage. And I need to know what you're seeing at home. And just by asking one or two open-ended questions where you're starting a dialogue is going to be all the difference. Because when we send all those papers home at orientation, it's just, you know, a tick in a box. We're not asking those questions that we need to be better educators. And so I would start with asking the parents one or two open-ended questions and letting them tell you. And it's amazing how much they will tell you once they know you're willing to hear what they have to say.
I agree with that, in particular, establishing that connection, right? Because that goes back to the same thing I was saying before. And I remember, like, early in my teaching career feeling that same way, like, well, I don't want to put them out. Well, I don't want to. And then I remember when my parents were both living, rest their souls, I remember saying that to them and them saying back to me, but if you don't ask, you're never going to know. So you're not putting them out. They're putting their child in your care. Why would you not talk to the person who's the expert on that kid? And even if they're not experts on that kid, they still have a vested interest. So making those connections really early and really often, and don't be afraid to talk to them, because while you're the teacher and they're the parent, you're not putting them out. You have expertise in your area. And just like Poonam said earlier, they have expertise in theirs. And even if they haven't figured it out yet, none of us, all of us are moms, and none of us have figured it out yet. And so when you consider it as that connectedness piece, and you're really trying to get the most data on that so you can make responsible decisions for what's going to work for that child in the classroom, that, I think, kind of shifts the mindset from putting them out to bringing them in, because they want to be brought in. They just don't know how to do that. And if they feel like, well, she's the expert in what she does, I don't want to say anything to her, then you don't get the information that you need, right? So be the person at the party that introduces the two people instead of wondering why they don't communicate.
Amazing. Thank you, panelists. Thank you, everyone. Hello.